All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Rodenberg, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Louise Delfrey Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, April 10th. First matter on the calendar for oral argument is the case of Pamela Maslowski versus Prospect Funding Partners. I know you're both familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you that you each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, and I guess we are considering you the appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments, and the podium can be raised or lowered with a button under the center of it to suit your needs. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Daniel Beckman. I'm here representing all three appellants, but primarily Prospect Funding NY, seeking a reversal of the trial court's determination that Minnesota law applies to the contract between Prospect Funding NY and the respondent, and seeking a reversal of the district court's determination that the contract is void because it is chambertous. With respect to the first issue on the choice of law, the court has, despite 3.5 years of litigation and two appeals in this case, all of the district court's decisions have been decisions based on the pleadings alone. There has been no substantive determinations, no factual arguments that have been presented to the trial court.
What was the agreement itself, the sale and purchase agreement, though, part of the complaint or attached to the complaint?
It was, Your Honor.
So that is within the scope of the judgment on the pleadings and our review?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it is, Your Honor. The trial court, however, in deciding the fact that Minnesota law applies to this contract, took judicial notice of certain facts and refused to take judicial notice of other facts that were in front of the district court. In doing so,
didn't the district court essentially take judicial notice of the other decisions?
It took judicial notice of other decisions. It relied upon some dicta in this court's earlier decision in this case, but it also failed to take notice of other facts that were in front of it, which suggested that some of the facts it was relying upon, for example, the fact that this clause was entered into as a result of the Williams decision, it ignored those facts and didn't take into account the timing of the fact that this contract involved in this case between Prospect Funding NY and Ms. Maslowski. Prospect Funding NY was not a party to the earlier Williams litigation. It had not been a party to any Minnesota litigation prior to that time. The fact of the matter is that the choice of law determination for New York was put into this contract prior to the time that there was any determination in the Williams case that had been issued in the earlier decision.
So what difference does that make in terms of the issues before us today?
Well,
do we review de novo these
yes.
issues? So, okay.
It is reviewed de novo, Your Honor. And the fact of the matter is that the Hagstrom case, as well as the Eighth Circuit Modern Computer case at 871 Fed Second 734, both indicate that it isn't sufficient just to try to attempt to apply some other jurisdiction's law, that there has to be something more, some sort of bad faith or malicious intent to try to avoid or evade Minnesota law.
And well, but the district court decided that, but not in the five-factor test that it applied. It did, and in fact, it ruled in your favor on that issue as to whether or not it was entered into in bad faith.
It did, Your Honor, and that's the mistake, but the district
why
court...
It was a mistake for the district court to rule in your favor on that issue?
No, it was a mistake for the district court to determine that Minnesota law applied and not to apply the choice of law clause where there was no bad faith.
So you're challenging the its analysis of the five factors?
No, we're challenging the analysis of the fact that the choice of law clause is not enforceable solely because Prospect Funding NY sought to have New York law applied. Essentially, the district court concluded that Minnesota law applied because there was an intent to evade Minnesota law. But taken to its logical conclusion, any choice of law clause is going to say we're going to try to evade the law of the state which we're not applying for whatever reason in that circumstance. And what Hagstrom and the other cases say is that you need something more than that. You need some specific intent to try to avoid the application of the law. Here, all Prospect Funding NY was attempting to do was consistently have New York law applied to its contracts. There's evidence in this case that it had choice of law New York clause in all of its contracts.
Kind of like credit card companies.
Correct. Yes. What it was seeking to do was have consistent interpretation of its contracts.
This well, and to avoid laws such as the law in Minnesota that's, I think, on one extreme in terms of what it considers champerous and thus void agreements. Correct?
At the time that this contract was drafted and entered into, there was no determination regarding these types of contracts in Minnesota.
But Johnson versus Wright was on the books in 2004.
Right, but that was not this sort of purchase and sale agreement. Johnson versus Wright was an agreement where an attorney was specifically providing financing to pursue litigation on behalf of somebody else, like the Gammons and Huber trilogy. Those cases certainly have been on the law, but they're distinguishable. And if we're going to, if the court wants, I can move into the Champerty argument.
But the Johnson case also looked at the extremely high fees. They're about, 27-28%, and here they're even higher than that. So that was one of the other key factors where Johnson is very similar to this case.
I think Johnson noted that, but it wasn't that. We would argue that that wasn't the basis for the ultimate decision, that the basis for the ultimate decision in Johnson versus...
Yeah, I'm not sure I read Johnson the same way. I think the court made very, very clear that that high interest rate led to the conclusion that it was a chapter-less agreement.
Well, champerty is the pursuit of somebody else's litigation on their behalf. The prospect
well,
funding,
or it's funding litigation you don't have an interest in, and making your repayment contingent on the outcome of litigation you don't have an interest in.
We would disagree with that conclusion, Your Honor, and we would...
How would you define, or how do you Champerty, believe that, that Minnesota law defines champerty?
Champerty law, as defined under Black's Law Dictionary, says that it is the pursuit on behalf of somebody else of their cause of action. And that's what was happening in the Huber versus Gammons cases, where Huber went out and drummed up all this business and then retained Gammons to pursue those cases, and the parties to the claims weren't even involved in the litigation. That's champerty.
Yes, and in that case, there was a 60% annual interest rate that was charged as well.
In Wright versus Johnson?
No. Wasn't that in Huber versus Johnson?
No, the Huber versus Gammons cases I'm referring to are the ones that happened right around the turn of the century in the late 1890s.
Right, Huber was 1897 for that case. Right,
there were two or three cases that all relied upon the same factual pattern.
Right, but in at least one of those, you had a 60% interest rate that was charged.
But if you read the analysis of the court, champerty and maintenance and verity have always been is effort on the part of courts to control their own docket. That's a public policy to say we don't want somebody else out there drumming up all this vexatious litigation pursuing somebody else's claims. That's not what's going on
here. Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court did say in one of those cases that that 60% interest rate was an example of the corrupt practices that it's designed to prevent, and it specifically referred to that amount and talked about it as being corrupt practices. And that's language from the Minnesota Supreme Court. So I don't see that as dicta there. I see that as relevant to that analysis of what is chapter is.
But that's not what the definition of champered is that was relied on in those cases that was quoted by Johnson versus Wright indicates.
But if you
there
get
has
back
always,
to the, oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
You can finish your answer.
There has always been something more that's been required than simply the fees. It's the actual pursuit of the litigation.
And that was my question. Johnson versus Wright doesn't seem to say it has to be the active pursuit of it. We conclude that because the recovery is tied to the outcome of the litigation, the 27.67% agreement is champered, as citing Black's Law Dictionary.
Well, but they also point out in that case that the attorney in that case was actually funding the litigation. He was pursuing the litigation, same as the Huber and Gammons cases. But Johnson and Wright were all funding the litigation. Here, the money that was provided through the purchase to Ms. Maslowski could have been used for anything and everything and had nothing to do with actual funding of the litigation.
Agreed, but the language in Johnson versus Wright seems to, reads to me that what the money was used for is not the issue. It's that recovery is tied to the outcome of the litigation.
And we would disagree.
I'm just quoting him.
Right. I understand that there's some language in there, but the analysis of the case still goes back to the fact that there was a use of that funds to fund the litigation. It was tied into the litigation. And that's really what, if you look at the definition of maintenance, that's what maintenance is. Maintenance is providing the funds to pursue the litigation. Again, it goes back
to... Which is what plaintiff's lawyers do often in terms of funding expenses associated with contingent fee matters.
That's true.
Right.
It's
and not, this is something wholly different. This was, you get $6,000, and if you recover any money, then we get a certain amount depending on how long it takes to recover the money.
Well, that's what a contingency fee is as well. I mean, the analysis of the Williams case and the analysis of the district court in this case is saying that the reason why this is a problem is because it's a disincentive to settle. There's certainly all sorts of things that become a disincentive to settle. Anybody who practices personal injury law in the state of Minnesota knows right now the two biggest disincentives to settlement are, number one, personal injury contingency fees, and number two, subrogation claims for medical expenses. Because by the time you take out the third contingency fee and pay back the medical expenses, the plaintiffs aren't hardly getting anything back.
But when you have lawyers collecting contingency fees, I mean, you're also dealing with a whole body of professional rules of conduct and things like that that govern how lawyers handle cases. I mean, this seems to me that there is a distinction that makes a difference between a lawyer entering into a contingent fee agreement under which she or he advances the cost of the litigation versus what the purchase agreement here and the connection between your client and Ms. Maslowski.
Well, let's look at the contract itself. First of all, the contract right on the first page specifies these are the terms, okay? This is what you're going to be getting. These are the amounts you have to pay back, and it's capped at a certain point. After a certain point in time, the amount of the repurchase price no longer goes up. It's set. That's disclosed right away up front. There's nothing hidden. The person knows what they're getting into. Number two, you have to be represented. The Prospect Funding NY will not enter into this agreement with you unless you have an attorney. And that attorney signs off on the contract and says, this is the terms, and I've explained the terms to my client.
Do you contend that the fact that a lawyer has to sign off and advise, in this case, his client about the impact of this sales and purchase agreement would take it outside of champerty law?
We contend that all of the terms of the contract take it outside of champerty law and that it's no longer champerty. The fundamental purpose of champerty is for the court to control its docket. This contract does not create any additional litigation.
I think it's more than just that.
Pardon me?
I think it's more than just the court controlling its docket in terms of what the policy behind champerty law.
Well, that's the reason why the Supreme Court in Gammons and the Huber cases said this is what we're trying to prevent, is all these people out there drumming up all this vexatious litigation. really what the court is doing now in Williams and in this case is talking about a legislative rule. They're saying, we don't really like this practice. We think these fees are too high, and for that reason, we're going to say that these are champerty. But the policy behind champerty is for the court to control its docket, something that the court certainly is able to do. But the court shouldn't step into the legislative role and say, we don't like this practice, we don't like this sort of thing going on here.
We don't as an error-correcting court, but the Minnesota Supreme Court can set policy, including interpreting and applying laws such as champerty
that
directly affect the practice of law and how litigants proceed.
That may be true, but the Supreme Court has not ruled that these types of purchase and repurchase contracts are champerty or are maintenance within the state of Minnesota at this point in time. And
they haven't?
No. There is no court case directly, I don't believe, that the Hammonds and Huber case are on point with respect to the factual background of what was going on in that case.
Huber, at least, was from the 19th century, correct?
Correct. Yes. And it's easy to see that at this day and age, you know, what's going to happen now in the Huber-Gammons situation if Gammons was the attorney and says, I can make a bunch of money on all these cases. You know, who's the Huber this day and age? It's the television stations. He's just going to go out and put an ad on TV and drum up. And so Barratry, as a practical matter, has all but disappeared from our state because we've accepted that from happening. But again, what you have to get back to is that the fundamental purpose of these prohibitions was the court trying to say, we don't want more litigation. We don't want people pursuing these questionable claims. There's nobody in this case that's saying that Ms. Maslowski had a questionable claim. Her claim was pending before this happened.
She sued it out before this deal was.
Yes, this case was already pending before the contract was entered into. And so the protections we would claim that are in this contract have been specifically designed to protect Ms. Maslowski, to make her aware of what her rights are, and to have her required to have legal representation. There are a number of...
In some ways, you're arguing that she waived her right to rely on the anti-champerty law of the state of Minnesota because, I mean, clearly this is a contingent contract, which would place it, as I read Johnson, right into the wheelhouse of champerty agreements. But the fact that she signed it with a lawyer and everything was disclosed sort of waives any argument she would have?
Well, again, we're going to have to disagree on what Johnson indicates because we think it's both the contingent outcome and the actual funding of the litigation that makes it champerty. If you read the Black's Law Dictionary of champerty, that's what it is. It's the pursuit of the litigation that makes it champerty. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. Counsel Matt Barber for the respondents and cross-appellants Maslowski and Schwebel. The district court did not err in deciding that this choice of law clause is not enforceable because Prospect admitted its intent to evade Minnesota law to this court, and it's published in this court's decision earlier in this case.
Well, but isn't that admission, I mean, something that any time there's a choice of law clause, couldn't you make that same argument that the drafter of this contract wanted New York, where it resided, law to apply? Why is that in and of itself indicative of some bad faith or at least intent to evade?
Because the Minnesota Supreme Court doesn't require more. Since 1893 in the Smith versus Parson case, which is cited by the Combined Insurance versus Bodie, all that's required to invalidate a choice of law clause is either bad faith or intent to evade Minnesota law. And that's the common law in Minnesota, and those are published decisions in this state.
So would that mean, if we followed your argument to its logical conclusion, that every choice of law provision in a contract that involves a Minnesota party that specifies the law of a different state would be invalid?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for that is most choice of law clauses are for consistency, not to evade some states' law, especially when it's had an earlier opinion saying your contracts are not enforceable because they're champertus. The facts of this case are unique.
Well, but are you really sure about that? Because companies all the time will file, for example, will state the choice of law to be Delaware because it's widely viewed as being more favorable to corporations rather than even if they're incorporated in their principal place of business is a different state. They will often choose Delaware law to avoid their own state's laws.
Right, and that would encourage a race to the bottom for other states, too, who want to have corporations and the tax benefits in their states.
But there isn't case law saying that just because a Minnesota corporation designates Delaware law, that is, and companies oftentimes make it very, very clear as to why. Everybody knows why. So why aren't all those situations in the same as this one here?
Right. The designation by itself, just a plain designation, isn't a problem. It's when the intent to evade the law is present. That's the problem
here.
Well,
but companies are intending to evade Minnesota law all the time by using Delaware law.
Right.
It's more favorable to corporations.
That's true. And under Minnesota common law, when you intend to evade Minnesota law and that fact is recognized, the Minnesota Supreme Court says that choice of law clause is not enforceable.
So intent to evade Minnesota law is a fact question, isn't it?
It is.
And was there any factual evidence? Was there any facts before the court or just the pleadings?
There were pleadings before this court, but at the Court of Appeals last time around, Prospect admitted its intent was to evade Minnesota law. That's why this court affirmed granting the anti-suit injunction, because the question is, are you intending to evade the law of another state? And if you are, then we enjoin it. As far as champerty goes, Minnesota law is very clear what champerty is, and we're going to start with Hackett versus Hamill. That's the Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1932, and there it explains there are only three parts to what champerty is. It's, are you related to one of the parties? Did you have an interest in the outcome of the underlying litigation beforehand? And is repayment contingent on the outcome? That's what champerty is. Nothing more is needed when you look at Hackett. And this court in Johnson versus Wright relies on that language from Hackett to explain that. Those are the only three things that are required. Nothing more is required.
Well, what's the significance of the fact that this particular purchase agreement, or sales and repurchase agreement, discloses all the information and, in fact, required Ms. Maslowski to have her lawyer review it and sign it and... had a couple of the certified that they had talked with your client about it. Shouldn't that make a difference in terms of whether that is a void or voidable agreement under Minnesota law?
It shouldn't, Your Honor, because it's still champertus, even though an attorney signs off on it. Illegal contracts are still illegal, even though someone might have been told by an attorney to sign the contract, or in this case, when it's a champertus contract like this, Ms. Maslowski needed money for rent and other living things, and she was desperate to get this money, so she needed it, and she directed our office to sign the letter. And just because we signed the letter doesn't make it any less champertus. And the facts of Johnson versus Wright really highlight that nothing more is required to show champerty. In that case, the funder did not hire the appellant's attorney. The funder did not undertake to prosecute the suit against Little Six and had no control over the legal matters. That's at page 677 of Johnson versus Wright. What the key factor is in Johnson versus Wright is that repayment is contingent on the outcome. And the Court of Appeals in Johnson versus Wright compares and contrasts the note and the two assignments in Johnson versus Wright. The Court of Appeals says if the note, which was just money up front, were contingent on the outcome, it would have been champertus. But because repayment was required no matter what happened, it was enforceable. The two assignments of percentages, because repayment was contingent on the outcome, that's why they were champertus.
So what's the difference between this situation and a contingent fee with a law firm?
Lawyers have obligations to their clients. They've got their clients' best interest in mind. Corporations, like Prospect, are just trying to maximize profits, so they don't have an obligation to do what their clients tell them to do, to do what's in the client's best interest, which might be settle a case or dismiss it without any funding like that. We've got obligations to the court and to our clients, lawyers do, and the only obligation Prospect has is to make money for its shareholders and members.
Well, doesn't a contingency fee by a law firm create a conflict of interest, inherent conflict of interest, because aren't they really ultimately trying, law firms are businesses as well. Aren't they really just trying to maximize their profits as well?
Not necessarily, no, because we're officers of the court. We're trying to effectuate what justice is in the state of Minnesota. So that's what we do when we have a case of an injured person. We're trying to get justice for them. And a contingency fee is allowed by the rules of professional conduct because we have all of these safeguards in place that govern rules for lawyers, whereas there's nothing like that in place for what Prospect is doing. And the reason for that is what Prospect does would be usury if it were a loan, but because they characterize this agreement as a sale instead of a loan, they're not subject to the usury laws and caps on interest like that.
But your colleague, when he signed off on this, knew about Minnesota's anti-champerty law, so knew that the client was being asked to enter into an invalid contract. And you say that lawyers have obligations not only to their clients but the courts. So I'm concerned that by signing this, your client waived a right to make this argument before us.
Right, but in Williams, the same thing happened. It's the same contract, the same funding party, and it was also champertous. So an attorney signing off on it doesn't take it outside the realm of champerty.
How does this purchase-repurchase agreement, sales and repurchase agreement here, differ from the classic loan receipt situation, which I don't know if they are used anymore because of changes in the law, but allowed people to fund various parts or to intermeddle in some existing litigation? How is this any different than that?
I'm not familiar with what a loan receipt is, Your Honor. But this agreement, on its plain terms, is champertous because Prospect is not related to any of the parties. It did not have an interest in the outcome, and funding or repayment is contingent on the outcome. As far as deciding the choice of law clause issue, the district court correctly relied on all the documents that were attached to the pleadings, namely our complaint, which included this contract, the Williams order, and the Williams contract. And the district court correctly took judicial notice of the published opinions of this court and the New York appellate division.
But it also thought that Williams indicated or was part of indicating the intent to avoid Minnesota law because it occurred before this case came up. But isn't it true that the documents were prepared before Williams?
That is true, but those documents were not attached to any pleadings, and Prospect has had two chances to plead that information and
didn't. What documents?
There's a contract of Prospect's that's dated, I think, 2 weeks after Williams moved for summary judgment, and their position is, well, because it was before the order came out, the timeline's off, but it's not a material change in the timeline. It was still in light of the Williams litigation. So whether it was 2 weeks after moving for summary judgment or 2 weeks after the order, it still stands that Prospect either used a different entity and new terms in its contract or different terms in its same contract in light of finding out that Minnesota does not enforce champerty contracts.
It sounds like the district court was doing fact-finding then.
It wasn't, Your Honor, because that information wasn't attached. So we moved to dismiss the third party complaint, and none of that information was attached to any of the pleadings or any of the motion papers. It wasn't brought up. And then we had to move for judgment on the pleadings based on our complaint. And that's when Prospect brought it up. And the district court correctly applied the law of the case doctrine to what was already decided.
I'm still trying to find where we said in the earlier appeal that Prospect agreed that it was their intent to avoid Minnesota law. It seems like Judge Larkin wrote that that was likely the case, and it appears that the forum selection clause is an attempt to avoid Minnesota's long-established policy that agreements for chaffinity are unenforceable. But I don't see, I don't find the concession on the part of appellant.
Right, it's on page 769. It's above, and I believe it's above and below the block quote from that early case that says intent to evade is a reason to have an anti-suit injunction.
Okay, I'll look for it.
Would ask you to comment on the attorney fees issue. I know you seek review of the denial of attorney's fees. You know, I'm looking at the Garrick versus Northland Insurance Company case from way back in the day. Garrick is still good law, is it not, in terms of when attorney's fees are recoverable in a declaratory judgment action?
That's when, if I'm remembering correctly, that's one where there was a denial of a duty to defend in an insurance coverage dispute?
I think it was a first-party case, but it talked about the Morrison exception,
right,
under which if attorney's fees are the damages flowing from the breach of contract, which is true when an insurer has not honored its duty to defend an insured, then attorney's fees are recoverable. But as I understand the law, unless there's a statute that provides for an award of attorney's fees or your contract spells it out, they're not generally available. It's the American rule, I think we call it, that each side bears their own costs. Why did the district court abuse its discretion in declining to award attorney fees here?
Right. So the decision whether or not to award attorney's fees is abuse of discretion, but construing a statute is de novo. And in Minnesota, we construe statutes in light of earlier Minnesota Supreme Court constructions of the statute.
So what statute provides for an award of attorney fees in this case?
It's the predecessor to 555.10 as construed.
That's declaratory judgment statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what language in there suggests that attorney fees are recoverable?
The language is identical, except for the word act was swapped out for chapter, I believe, or maybe vice versa. But in 1935, when Andrist decided it, it looked at the word costs and said, if the equities require it, then costs could include attorney's fees. And in that case, There was a declaratory judgment action in addition to a regular trustee issue. And the court said, because you've got this declaratory judgment action part of it and the trustee was in court at all times defending that construction, attorney's fees could be awarded if the district court determines that it would be equitable to do so. So we're just asking for a remand on the equities issue.
But a couple points. Are there any published cases where attorney fees actually have been granted under 555.10?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, and the only thing we've been able to find, and I think the district court said it were two unpublished cases, but even in those unpublished cases, there is no finding of attorney fees. But even if our standard of review is abuse of discretion, and it's may in terms of what the statute, in terms of whether or not the district court can grant attorney fees, so we generally defer to the district court. So why should we remand? How did the district court abuse its discretion by denying the request for attorney fees?
Right. So we would go to, first, it's de novo about construction, and then abuse of discretion would be not following the law. And we cited Andrist and explained that Andrist construed it as allowing attorney's fees if the equities allow, and the district court did not follow Andrist. It cited an absence of published decision on it, even though we produced Andrist, and then didn't do the equitable finding. So that would be abuse of discretion for not following the law there.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Beckman, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, to follow up on this so-called admission, there has been no admission by my clients in this case that they're seeking to evade Minnesota law. What the argument was earlier, what the argument is now, what the intent was, is to apply New York law. Prospect funding.
It may not be necessarily an admission, but I think what happened in the earlier case is the district court made it as part of its finding that the intent was to avoid
the
Minnesota
district
law.
Court was relying upon language in the earlier Court of Appeals decision at page 769. First of all, we don't think that that's what the earlier Court of Appeals decision actually says, and you can look at the language
there. You did challenge the district court's finding there, but that's part of the findings of the district court. And in our opinion, we affirmed the district court's findings. We never found that those findings were clearly erroneous. So that seems to be set there.
Well,
it says, when weighing this equities, the district court found that Prospect, quote, acted in a calculated and systematic manner, end quote, to deprive the Minnesota courts of their jurisdiction to determine whether pre-settlement funding contracts affecting Minnesota lawsuits are chaperatous. Prospect assigns error to the district court's findings together in its actions and motivation. However, Prospect cannot dispute and indeed argues that the purpose of the forum selection clause and choice of law provision is to ensure application of New York law instead of Minnesota law. That seems to be...
That's true, Your Honor.
That's my credit card again.
Yes, it is. It's the same questions that you asked of the respondent. Yes, we seek to apply New York law. Yes, we sought at that time to have the New York forum decide it. It was because we wanted the application of New York law. It wasn't because we were trying to evade Minnesota law for any sort of specific nefarious purpose.
Prospect Does it make a difference if the law to be evaded or the law that's being chosen is different because the contract would be completely void under one state's law, not just more favorably interpreted, but, I mean, the question is either it's a valid contract or it's not a valid contract.
We don't think so, Your Honor. If you read the Hagstrom case and the Eighth Circuit case that is cited in there, there was a specific argument to that effect in that case, that Minnesota public policy regarding termination of distributorship agreements had this specific provision under the Minnesota law that wasn't, in effect, under the North Dakota choice of law provision, and the court in that case said that's not enough in and of itself. There has to be some bad faith or some other nefarious type conduct in order to get you outside of the effectiveness of the choice of law clause.
Well, but what we said in the in the earlier Maslowski case is that the district court's well-reasoned analysis assures us that the district court did not err in concluding that equitable principles favor maintaining the suit in Minnesota. It seemed like the district court had a fairly reasoned opinion here and careful analysis. Why shouldn't we be reaching the same result that essentially we did in the first?
It's a different issue, Your Honor, now, whether or not we require everybody to go off to New York as to whether we're here in Minnesota because Ms. Maslowski is here and...
All the other parties are here.
It's different. Well, Prospect Funding NY was not here, and nobody realized that at the time because there was some confusion over what the correct party was. Prospect Funding NY wasn't even actually technically a party to that earlier appeal. It only got added later. And that's stemmed from the fact that Prospect Funding LLC, there were two entities. One was a New York entity, and so there was some confusion. But the fact of the matter is that that has been cleared up now and no longer applies. And now we're talking about a different issue because we're just talking about application of New York versus Minnesota law as opposed to going there. So it is a different issue at this point in time. I did want to follow up as well on a couple of points that the respondent made. The Hackett case... on the second page of that decision, specifically states, the vice of it was that a layman with no interest in the lawsuit or its subject matter and no relation to defendant advanced money to carry on the litigation. So that is the analysis of that case. That's the analysis of the earlier cases, even in the Williams decision where they say, where the court says, we conclude that because recovery is tied to the outcome, it is chamfered. That isn't the ultimate reasoning for the whole decision because the court earlier indicated they're funding, the attorney's funding the litigation here. While he's funding the litigation and he's got an interest in the outcome, then it becomes chamfered because right after that conclusion, they cite the Black's Law Dictionary quote that it has to be pursuing the litigation. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. It's an interesting case. We will take it under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. The next matter on the calendar for oral argument is Dewey Hill Townhomes Association versus Auto Owners Insurance Company.